Welcome to Graciously Confident, podcast from the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. In this series, we're examining the Church's response and our own responses to the assisted dying legislation that's being considered in the UK and Ireland. I'm Will Leach, I'm a journalist and broadcaster, and we hope that this short series will help you understand and respond. Last time we took a look at the legislation across the UK and Ireland and concluded that there is a better way than assisted suicide. But what is the alternative? It means understanding what palliative care is and what palliative care isn't. We have help with that. I'm pleased to welcome back the Reverend Professor Max Watson. We also have Dr. Matthew Doerr. Max and Matt are palliative care consultants. Both have wide experience in palliative care and the issues around it. Both of you, thanks for helping us get to grips with this, and welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Matt, how do you understand what's meant by good palliative end-of-life care?
That is the fundamental question, really, isn't it? Good palliative care, good end-of-life care, is when we see the person, no matter what situation they're in, what circumstances they found themselves in, with awful terminal illness, say, or they're about to lose their family, or even a kid losing their life and their parents watching. It is about treating that person as a person, fundamentally seeing them as the most important thing and trying to work with it. Palliative care was founded, actually, on the principles of Christian doctrine, Cicely Saunders, really. And it's seeing the person as an immeasurable and irreducible, valuable human, and not seeing it as a something which in the past, in medicine in the past, was kind of, well, we can't do anything more, go back home. We can't do anything more with surgery or chemotherapy, that go back home. And palliative care has taken that void and saying, no, you are important no matter what happens to you and what circumstances you find yourself in. And therefore, palliative care is built upon that premise of that immeasurable, irreducible value, which is actually the true meaning of the word dignity. Dignity is that innate value of a person, not synonymous with choice. Choice is part of it, don't get me wrong. Autonomy is part of it. But it's dignity is actually seeing the person as important and special. That is what palliative care is.
How would you define it, Max?
I think it's the sort of care that you would want for yourself or your loved ones when they come to the end of their life. The WHO would talk about the importance of ensuring that physical, emotional, and spiritual needs are being addressed. So it's holistic care, looking at all the aspects that go into making a human being, and looking after those aspects when the time of life coming to an end is taking place. So the skills involved, yes, they're about medicines, but they're also about communication. They're also about social need and financial need and spiritual need. So it's looking at the sort of care that you would want for yourself or your mummy or somebody else dear to you at their end of life.
You would say it's the better way than ending someone's life earlier than it might otherwise have ended. Why is it a better way?
I think the concept of ending life as a so-called better way is a very new one. It's only like 25 years since the real legislation began to be come about, initially in Oregon. Switzerland is different, and it was earlier. But this is a trend against hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years.
I think what Max is also mentioning is when you see someone as an innately valuable, you don't see them as just your worth is based on what you do or what you have achieved or what circumstances you're in. It is based purely on the fact you are you. So when I do the definition of dignity in terms of being innately, immeasurably, irreducibly valuable, that is what I mean as the heart, because what assisted dying does, assisted suicide, euthanasia does, is it is basically saying there is a point where you reach in your life where you're not valuable anymore. Yeah. You're not worth anything anymore. And that there are circumstances which society accept in which it's better off if you're dead. Now, often that ethos seeps through. Well, actually, you're going to suffer horribly. By the way, that is largely completely untrue, because that is something in which, well, palliative care specialises in. That's what Max and I really specialise in. It's this misconception you're going to die painfully and suffering. Not true. There is a very, very, very small minority in which that's my job. But the vast, vast, vast majority, not the case. And therefore, we say, no, you are valuable and I want to look after you. And we let nature take its course. By the way, palliative care ethos is we let nature take its course, but we control what nature throws at us. So if it's throwing at us symptoms, it's throwing at us psychological, it's throwing at us social, it's throwing at us spiritual, then we're trying to address those things and then and give them a good death in terms of the last chapter of their life, closing it the way is in keeping with their whole life, not foreshortening it.
I don't actually see ending your life as a way. It's kind of contradictory to life, because actually you're bringing in active dying. And I guess why I hiccup over this, excuse me, but I'm going to quote not the Bible, but the Spice Girls. Tell me what you want, what you really, really want. And what we really, really want, I think, is that people have really good quality dying at the end of life. I don't think a doctor coming up to you and injecting you with medicines which haven't been licensed, haven't been, all the problems that we know exist, is necessarily the best way to end life. If what you really, really want is good quality dying, palliative care has got a lot more to offer than assisted dying, assisted suicide.
It therefore almost, from what you're saying to me, seems to negate a lot of the arguments that people make in favour of this legislation, because they say, look, it's cruel and heartless not to allow people to end their suffering. From where you two seem to be coming from, that's irrelevant.
A lot of people use the analogy, and we'll just address them head on, things like you wouldn't let a pet go through this, for example. You'd put down a dog. But the fundamental thing is, you are not a dog. You are not, you are human, again, returning to the innate dignity. But also, just to outline some data around that sort of pet analogy in terms of you wouldn't let a dog suffer through this. Well, the dog can't consent, first of all, and which is also worrisome. But then also, the vast majority, I think it's 80% of pets are not insured, they are put down because they can't afford the treatments. And that is not actually really articulated very well. If you think about it, most animals are put down because they cannot afford the treatment. That foreshortening of life because of economic pressures is not something to shy away from. That is real. That is true. And that there are people thinking about those kind of economic decisions in the background as well.
I think in this debate, in order to win it, in order to get it through the Commons, people tend to cite really extreme examples. They talk about awful situations with, they talk about bodily fluids, they talk about awful pain, they talk about agonies. And I would not be someone to stand up and say, oh, you didn't really suffer that, and that wasn't really happening. But what I would be really concerned about is why that person did not have access to the support of care that I've seen in the Northern Ireland Hospice where Matt works and where I work over in OMA, where we don't see those extreme examples, and that there is the skill and there are the resources out there to reduce suffering. And where suffering is emotional and causing a lot of distress, we are allowed under the current legislation to reduce that as well. We're not in the business of prolonging dying. Equally, we're not in the business of shortening life. That's the space in which palliative care operates.
Because in the debates, there were people who were saying palliative care is hand-holding with morphine, it's lives being deliberately shortened. It's not that.
No.
No, our goal is always to reduce suffering. And we're allowed to use the medications and the treatments and that are available to us to reduce suffering. That's our compass bearing. And under the current legislation, that gives us a good amount of leeway about what to do. We're not in the business of prolonging life just for the sake of prolonging life. We are in the business of reducing suffering.
Reducing suffering isn't killing the sufferer. And that is a really important distinction to make. You don't reduce suffering by killing the sufferer. We let nature take its course, but we control what nature throws at us. And then we take this incredibly seriously. We're not shortening time or lengthening time. So when I'm withdrawing a treatment, I'm withdrawing it to return to the natural course of events. So I'm not precipitating death. That's the fundamental difference. If I, in assisted dying, I'm giving a lethal medication to end your life, withdrawing something, I'm withdrawing something which is returning you to the natural course of events. And they're very, very different philosophies to kind of hold. And I understand the confusion, but they are very different.
I worked in Nepal with the church for many years, and I was in charge of obstetrics. So I see a huge overlap between obstetrics and palliative care. It's about getting a good delivery for a natural process. What we're about in palliative care is getting a good, normal life end.
We saw then, during all the political debates, and there will be others, some MPs, MLAs, MSPs, whatsoever, clearly didn't understand some of the issues as we see it. We've made it clear that we don't consider palliative care to be prolonging life unnecessarily. So you can see, both of you, how in the eyes of society, the whole concept of end-of-life care, palliative care, can be seen as a negative thing, and you very much want to portray it as a natural and normal thing. Is that right?
Very much so. Very much so. I would also like to speak specifically to some members of our church who feel that they must accept fifth-line chemotherapy. They must go into intensive care unit. They must do absolutely everything possible to keep their lives going. And some people can feel really that that is what the Christian responsibility is. Medical science has radically changed over the last 20, 30 years. People can be kept alive. But under current legislation, there can be a point when we are allowed to say, no, I do not want to have these further treatments. And that's not betraying your faith or going against the current legislation. And I have a fear sometimes that people feel that they're duty bound because of their faith, that they need to accept the unacceptable face of over-medicalization. We don't. And part of the problem is that medicine has over-medicalized this normal end-of-life process. So to be able to die in your own home with your family around you, with the dog, with the music, for life to come to its natural summation, sometimes it's really hard for that to happen in our over-medicalized world.
Matt?
What assisted dying does, it portrays across the general population, it creates this unspoken pressure. Now, people call that choice, but that choice very rapidly in all the other jurisdictions becomes a suggestion and then expands to essentially an expectation under certain circumstances that they seek assisted dying. Now, what that does, it takes away from palliative care, because that societal expectation of accessing lethal medications under those circumstances means that, well, actually you are a burden on people and taking up people's time to look after you. And it just takes away that natural narrative of palliative care, of a demedicalized natural dying, which is there's medical aspects, of course there are, in terms of the control of symptoms, and we're very, very good at it. But all the wider aspects of it are not, the bigger aspects are not actually medical, the social, psychological, spiritual. That's why we have such wide, what's called multidisciplinary teams of social workers, psychologists, chaplains and brilliant nurses, all of them sort of working together for that purpose.
Death is not a medical event. It's a human event. We all only get the chance to do it once. And I am concerned that the narrative around assisted dying is not actually true to our lived experience of looking after thousands of people who are dying. But I understand why people have the fear and the concern about it. I think people are very worried about coming onto a palliative care ward because they have all sorts of notions that it's a place where we go around in black capes and everybody is looking mournful and we're just one step away from the pearly gates. When actually, it's a fun, exciting opportunity to be with people and to grow. And there's not a day when I don't learn, when patients don't teach me. It's about life. It's not about death.
How many times have patients, terrified, come into the hospice, even vocalizing, I want to end it all, and then they realize that we're imbuing them with value and worth and dignity, and they realize, ah, this is okay. And they realize that dying, although desperately sad, can't take that away from anyone. It isn't in of itself suffering. It's not painful. Desperately sad, but not painful.
I think we can agree that the two of you think palliative care is a positive thing. Let's move into how you get it in society, where it's available, who makes it available. And as everything comes down to in something that's done for people in society, who's paying for it? Because the government doesn't automatically, through a health service or any other system, pay for all the palliative care that people get. In the UK, Northern Ireland, slightly different in the Republic. How would you summarise it?
I would summarise that we are cake sale dependent in Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. In the Republic of Ireland now, hospice care is totally funded by the government, who feel that it is a fundamental part and should be a fundamental part of the health service. So with this legislation, as we said in the first episode, we could have a situation where we have a funded death service, but we rely on cake sales to fund our palliative care service. That, to me, is not about choice. That, to me, is about ideological fundamentalism. We need to bring in assisted dying no matter what. And that scares me. And it scares me when I hear that the Canadian government has saved 1.05 billion Canadian dollars last year with the introduction of MAID, medically assisted dying. And my fear, I worry because there could be an agenda here that assisted dying could save money and save the country from the issue of an increased number of elderly, frail people and a decreased ability to look after them.
How does it look across the UK, Matt, from health trust to health trust to health trust? Because it doesn't look like they're all given the same orders about what to do about palliative care, or indeed that they approach it the same way.
You're quite correct. So on average, it's 37% funded. That was in 2021, I think, by Sue Ryder, is the average commissioned rate across the UK.
37%.
So it's, well, 63% is charity funded through cake sales and charity shops.
And thank God for the people that raise the money.
Absolutely.
Now, that is incredibly variable as well. So I would say it goes up to a maximum of around 50% and goes far below 30%. The 37% is the average. And that means that there is a postcode lottery to access to palliative care. Now, palliative care services are not uniform either because it's charitably funded. There's a whole remit of different hospices, different charities, from Marie Curie to Sue Ryder to NI Hospice to OMA to Foyle. There is loads and loads of different charities, and they all have slightly different services as well. And then there's also in the hospitals, which is generally commissioned by the trusts, but they are incredibly short-staffed. The problem is there's no uniform palliative care provision, and there needs to be service specifications across everything. There's no strategy in Northern Ireland, for example. There's no policy in Northern Ireland. In UK, it's very, very variable as well. How can it be true choice if taxpayers pay for assisted dying services, the NHS provides those 100%, yet palliative care is predominantly charitably funded?
Is there uniformity in the way GPs understand palliative care, reflect that understanding to patients, refer people and so on, or does it vary in a similar way?
That's a good question. My wife's a GP. I've been a former GP. I think general practice is changing rapidly, as we know, and the pressures on general practice mean that modern general practice, there is an option of not doing palliative care, which there wasn't that option even 10 years ago. Everybody was involved with it. Awareness of general practice, I think GPs are taught a lot about palliative care. They are aware, but different areas of Northern Ireland have got different access to different services. So the opportunities that GPs have for accessing palliative care will vary considerably. We have an excellently funded, supported NHS palliative care unit, for example, in Antrim. But that level of funding is not in Belfast, is not in Omagh, is not in Derry. Why is that? Why do commissioners commission in one place to an adequate level and not in another? So that affects GPs and their understanding about what services they can access and what services will actually be practically available. Because while we may have our 9 or 10 beds in Omagh, if those beds are full, what does a GP in Enniskillen area do? You know, so I think GPs are well aware of palliative care because they provide or supervise or support probably 90% of palliative care that takes place across Ireland, because 90% of the time that people in the last phase of life spend will be at home. So they are the experts in that area and we are supporting them. So I would want to turn it on its head a bit.
Yeah. We mentioned, Matt, that there's 100% state funding for palliative care in the Republic of Ireland. Is it good care? Could it be better care? Could it be bigger provision?
It's good care. They do charitably raise for what's called enhanced supplements on top of that. But the basic cost of all of the beds in the hospices and the costs for the care is 100%, which is amazing. Palliative care is also a specialty. And what may surprise some of your listeners is that our discharge rate for the hospice is actually around 50%. We do the dying thing, definitely. That's 50%. Equal people go home again.
Which is very similar to the same rates for hospital discharge. We're not far off. Matt and I have got to be very careful because we're both married to GPs, so we don't want to get that wrong. And
they're just great.
They are fantastic, and they come home very late and they work really, really hard. And that's why I would liken the funding for hospice care should be similar to the funding for intensive care, because we provide intensive care to patients. So not everybody needs a hospice, not needs that complexity of care, but where it is needed, you need a well-staffed, well-planned-for specialist service across a population so we have the right number of beds to meet what we know is the need for our area.
We would love 100% funding. We would love uniform policies. We don't have them yet. But here we are in a podcast made by a council of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland saying things need to be different. So the question anybody could legitimately ask now is, are you going to put your money where your mouth is? Are you going to take action? What does Presbyterian Church in Ireland do practically about this issue?
It would be fantastic to think that churches would develop links with their local hospice unit. Wouldn't it be lovely if we had a one Sunday a year when there was an opportunity for people to contribute to that service? And wouldn't it be fantastic if there was a call from across our church to write to the health minister, to let him know how we as a community would like to see end-of-life care prioritised within our cash-strapped NHS. What are your thoughts, Matt?
I would expand that even more, to be honest. A bit of history, as you know from the abortion debate, Roe versus Wade, the pro-life movement actually started after the abortion bill came through. So it was the year after. So what we should be doing is now actually really articulating this so we don't make the same mistakes of the past, and talking not only external to everyone, and I would expand that to talking to the House of Lords. That's where the Kim Leadbeater bill is now. You can write to any Lord or Baroness. There's no restriction on it. But also within the church, actually looking at this within the Bible studies, within the home groups, within the church talking, and for ministers to get acquainted with this topic as well, and to really, really understand that this is talking about the value of life. And that is fundamental to every Christian doctrine, actually.
Our worry is we see this as very much the thin end of the wedge, that if you start to say that a life only has so much value, and once it's used up that value, it can be got rid of, that will very quickly overflow into every sort of area. What are we going to say then to that child with Down syndrome? What are we going to say to that person with a learning disability? Are we saying they're of no value? But if it comes down to the commoditization of human beings, then we're saying that this is a world of meritocracy, which is the exact opposite of what Jesus has said, that he is there for everyone has value.
You both mentioned churches and church involvement in philosophy and influencing society. Churches do also do practical things in providing palliative care. They provide funding, they provide resources, they provide places, they provide chaplains, don't they? Are we doing that?
Yes. I mean, I would always want more. I think as a Western church, as a Western society, we have gradually become increasingly individualistic. And what we see in palliative care in India and Nepal is that rather than there being individual autonomy, individual choice, it becomes a family unit. And it's an expectation, it's a privilege that the family look after their most vulnerable. This is the key thing. Everyone becomes vulnerable at some point in their lives. When you are faced with a terminal illness, when you're faced with that situation, you are vulnerable. This is what practically we're incredibly worried about, because no matter how assured you are, when you're faced with that terminal diagnosis, you are scared, and that's normal. You think, what can I do? They get pushed. They feel a burden. The question becomes, how many, what we call incorrect deaths, how many people would access assisted dying, those lethal medications, because they feel a burden on society? How many people say would prefer their money to go to their kids rather than pay for their nursing home? How many of those do we accept as a society?
You can't legislate for that. You can't legislate for the inner feelings that people may have.
So give me a final word, Max, on, instead of that frightening scenario that Matt unfolds, what do you offer instead? What do you say to people? Not that way, but this way.
And what I say is that, back to that word, gracious. Gracious. We have an opportunity to show a different way. And that is the way that during our lives, we look after and support and encourage those who are vulnerable. And in turn, we expect and are willing to accept the care and support of others when we are vulnerable.
The Reverend Professor Max Watson, Dr. Matthew Doerr, thank you both very much for joining us and for helping us understand more. Don't forget, the Presbyterian Church in Ireland has a resource hub on assisted dying and euthanasia. It's called Living and Dying Well. It's a great resource to help you think about all this, and you can see who's written what and the points they make. And thanks to you for listening. The next part of this series takes a hard, realistic look at all of this, the lived experience. We'll be hearing from people who've helped a loved one in the final months of their life and from someone who's living with a life-limiting illness. You can find that episode where you find this one, and do join us again soon. Bye-bye.